And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here. Sorry about last week. It was absolutely unavoidable. Had to pay a visit to a dental surgeon. It really thrilled me, I can tell you. Anyway, not to worry. We'll be continuing on with our, and concluding, in fact, our Lovecraft story. But before we do, a word from our sponsors.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
David! Where are you?
I'm over here behind all the boxes and the old piano.
I really think we need to get rid of some of this junk, don't you?
Junk? It's not junk, woman.
I know. I'll call Braidwood and District Storage. They have a range of storage units and you can access your treasures 24 hours, 7 days a week. Call us today for a quote on 0407 701 788. Braidwood and District Storage, proud sponsors of Braidwood FM.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club,
your local friendly club.
Whether you're looking for a round of golf, a delicious meal, or a drink with friends, the Braidwood Servicemen's Club boasts a range of recreational and sporting facilities to cater for every taste.
The restaurant provides Chinese and Australian meals and is open for lunch and dinner Tuesday to Sunday.
Braidwood Servicemen's Club, 4842 2108.
Located on the corner of Coronation Avenue and Victory Street, Braidwood.
A sponsor of
Braidwood FM.
Located on 28 acres of natural bushland beside the pristine Mongalo River, Tombara is conveniently located only 15 minutes drive from the historic town of Braidwood, just over an hour from Canberra and 50 minutes from Batemans Bay. More energetic outdoor options are some wonderful bushwalking opportunities or in Braidwood, a round of golf, the Heritage Walk or the Braidwood Art Galleries. You can contact the manager on 0448 533 616. Tom Barra, proud to be a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Education needs, from big to small.
And as always, a big thank you to our sponsor, or sponsors in that case. Well, continuing on with our story, our Lovecraft story, and you may remember that this is the story of a man who seems to be undergoing some type of change because of a transference of personality. In the lights of Biddeford and Sacco, I saw his firmly set mouth and shivered at the blaze of his eyes. The people were right. He did look damnably like his wife and like old Ephraim when in these moods. I did not wonder what the moods were, that the moods were disliked. There was certainly something unnatural and diabolic in them. And I felt the sinister element all the more because of the wild ravings I had been hearing. This man, for all my lifelong knowledge of Edward Pickham Derby, was a stranger, an intrusion of some sort from the black abyss. He did not speak until we were on a dark stretch of road, and when he did, his voice seemed utterly unfamiliar. It was deeper, firmer, and more decisive than I had ever known it to be, while its accent and pronunciation were altogether changed, though vaguely, remotely, and rather disturbingly, recalling something I could not quite place. There was, I thought, a trace of very profound and very genuine irony in the timbre, not the flashy, meaninglessly jaunty pseudo-irony of the callow sophisticate which Derby had habitually affected, but something grim, basic, pervasive, potentially evil. I marvelled at the self-possession so soon following the spell of panic-struck muttering. "I hope you'll forget my attack back there, Upton," he was saying. "You know what my nerves are. I guess you can excuse such things. I'm enormously grateful, of course, for this lift home. And you must forget, too, any crazy things I may have been saying about my wife and things in general. Yeah, that's what comes from the overstudy in a field like mine. My philosophy is full of bizarre concepts, and when the mind gets worn out, it cooks up all sorts of imaginary concrete applications. I shall take a rest from now on. You probably won't see me for some time, and you needn't blame Asenath for it. This trip was a bit queer, but it's really very simple. There are certain Indian relics in the North Woods, standing stones and all that, which mean a good deal in folklore, and Asenath and I are following that stuff off. It was a hard search, so I seem to have gone off my head. I must send somebody for the car when I get home. A month's relaxation will put me back on my feet. I do not recall just what my own part of the conversation was, for the baffling alienage of my seatmate filled all my consciousness. With every moment, my feeling of elusive cosmic horror increased, till at length I was in a virtual delirium of longing for the end of the drive. Derby did not offer to relinquish the wheel, and I was glad of the speed with which Portsmouth and Newburyport flashed by. At the junction where the main highway runs inland and avoids Innsmouth, I was half afraid my driver would take the bleak shore road that goes through that damnable place. He did not, however, but darted rapidly past Rowley and Ipswich toward our destination. We reached Arkham before midnight and found the lights still on at the old Crowanshield house. Derby left the car with a hasty repetition of his thanks, and I drove home alone, the curious feeling of relief. It had been a terrible drive, all the more terrible, because I could not quite tell why, and I did not regret Derby's forecast of a long absence from my company. The next 2 months were full of rumours. People spoke of seeing Derby more and more in his new, energised state, and Asenath was scarcely ever into her few callers. I had only one visit from Edward, when he called briefly in Asenath's car, duly reclaimed from wherever he had left it in Maine, to get some books he had lent me. He was in his new state and paused only long enough for some evasively polite remarks. It was plain that he had nothing to discuss with me when in this condition, and I noticed that he did not even trouble to give the old 3-2 signal when ringing the doorbell. And on that evening in the car, I felt a faint, infinitely deep horror, which I could not explain, so that his swift departure was a prodigious relief. In mid-September, Derby was away for a week, and some of the decadent college set talked knowingly of the matter, hinting at a meeting with some notorious cult leader lately expelled from England who had established headquarters in New York. For my part, I could not get that strange ride from Maine out of my head. The transformation I had witnessed had affected me profoundly, and I caught myself again and again trying to account for the thing and for the extreme horror it had inspired in me. But the oddest rumours were those about the sobbing in the old Crowanshield house. The voice seemed to be a woman's, and some of the younger people thought it sounded like Asenath's. It was heard only at rare intervals, and would sometimes be choked off, well, as if by force. There was talk of an investigation, but this was dispelled one day when Asenath appeared in the streets and chatted in a sprightly way with a large number of acquaintances, apologising for her recent absences and speaking incidentally about the nervous breakdown and hysteria of a guest from Boston. The guest was never seen, but Asenath's appearance left nothing to be said. And then someone complicated matters by whispering that the sobs had, once or twice, been in a man's voice. One evening, in mid-October, I heard the familiar 3-2 ring at the front door. Answering it myself, I found Edward on the steps, and saw, in a moment, that his personality was the old one, which I had not encountered since the day of his ravings on that terrible ride from Chesuncook. His face was twitching with a mixture of odd emotions in which fear and triumph seemed to share dominion, and he looked furtively over his shoulder as I closed the door behind him. Following me clumsily to the study, he asked for some whiskey to steady his nerves. I forbore to question him, but waited till he felt like beginning whatever he wanted to say. At length he ventured some information in a choking voice. "Asenath is gone, Dad. We had a long talk last night while the servants were out, and I made a promise to stop preying on me. Of course, I had certain occult defences I never told you about. She had to give in, but got frightfully angry. just packed up and started for New York, walked right out to catch the 8:20 into Boston. I suppose people will talk, but I can't help that. You needn't mention that there was any trouble. Just say she's gone on a long research trip. She's probably going to stay with one of her horrible groups of devotees. I hope she'll go west and get a divorce. Anyhow, I've made a promise to keep away and let me alone. It was horrible, Dan. She was stealing my body, crowding me out, making a prisoner of me. I laid low and pretended to let her do it, but I had to be on the watch. I could plan, if I was careful, for she can't read my mind literally or in detail. All she could read of my planning was a sort of a general mood of rebellion. She always thought I was helpless. Never thought I could get the best of her, but I had a spell or two that worked. Derby looked over his shoulder and took some more whiskey. I paid off those damn servants this morning. When they got back, they were ugly about it and asked questions, but they went. They're her kind, Innsmouth people, and were hand in glove with her. I hope they'll let me alone. I didn't like the way they laughed when they walked away. I must get as many of Dad's old servants again as I can. I'll move back home now. I suppose you think I'm crazy, Dan, but Arkham history ought to hint at things that back up what I've told you and what I'm going to tell you. You've seen one of the changes, too, in your car after I told you about Asenath. That day coming home from Maine, that was when she got me, drove me out of my body. And the last thing of the ride I remember was when I was all worked up trying to tell you what a she-devil is. Then she got me, and in a flash I was back at the house in the library where them damned servants had me locked up, and in that cursed fiend's body that isn't even human. You know, it was she you must have ridden home with, that praying wolf in my body. You ought to have known the difference. I shuddered as Derby paused. Surely I had known the difference, yet could I accept an explanation as insane as this? But my distracted caller was growing even wilder. I had to save myself. I had to, Dan. She'd have got me for good at Halamas. They held a Sabbath up there beyond Chesuncook. The sacrifice would have clinched things. She'd have got me for good. She'd have been I, and I'd have been she. Forever. Too late. My body would have been hers for good. She'd have been a man and fully human, just as she wanted to be. I suppose she'd have put me out of the way, killed her own ex-body with me in it, damn her, just as she did before. Just as she, he, it did before. Edward's face was now atrociously distorted, and he bent it uncomfortably close to mine as his voice fell to a whisper. You must know what I hinted in the car, that she isn't Asenath at all, but old Ephraim himself. I suspected it a year and a half ago, but I know it now. Her handwriting shows it when she's off guard. Sometimes she jots down a note in writing that's just like her father's manuscript, stroke for stroke. Sometimes she says things that nobody but an old man like Ephraim could say. He changed forms with her when he felt death coming. She was the only one he could find with the right kind of brain and a weak enough will. He got her body permanently, just as she almost got mine, and then poisoned the old body he'd put her into. Haven't you seen old Ephraim's soul glaring out of that she-devil's eyes a dozen times, and out of mine when she had control of my body? The whisperer was panting and paused for breath. I said nothing, and when he resumed, his voice was nearer to normal. This, I reflected, was a case for the asylum, but I would not be the one to send him there. Perhaps time and freedom from Asenath would do its work. I could see that he would never wish to dabble in morbid occultism again. I'll tell you more later. I must have a long rest now. I'll tell you something of the forbidden horrors she led me into, something of the age-old horrors that even now are festering in out-of-the-way corners with a few monstrous priests to keep them alive. Some people know things about the universe that nobody ought to know, and can do things that nobody ought to be able to do. I've been in it up to my neck, but that's the end. Today I burned that damn Necromicon and the rest, if I were librarian at Miskatonic. But she can't get me now. I must get out of that accursed house as soon as I can and settle down at home. You'll help me, I know, if I need help. Those devilish servants, you know. And if people should get too inquisitive about Asenath, you see, I can't give them her address. There are certain groups of searchers, certain cults, you know, that might misunderstand our breaking up. Some of them have damnably curious ideas and methods. I know you'll stand by me if anything happens, even if I have to tell you a lot that will shock you." I had Edward stay and sleep in one of the guest chambers that night, and in the morning he seemed calmer. We discussed certain possible arrangements for his moving back into the Derby mansion, and I hoped he would lose no time in making the change. He did not call next evening, but I saw him frequently during the ensuing weeks. We talked as little as possible about strange and unpleasant things, but discussed the renovation of the old Derby house and the travels which Edward promised to take with my son and me the following summer. Of Asenath we said almost nothing, for I saw the subject was a peculiarly disturbing one. Gossip, of course, was rife, but that was no novelty in connection with the strange menage at the old Crowninshield house. One thing I did not like was what Derby's banker let fall in an overexpansive mood at the Miskatonic Club, about the cheques Edward was sending regularly to a Moses and Abigail Sargent and a Eunice Babson in Innsmouth. That looked as if those evil-faced servants were extorting some kind of tribute from him, yet he had not mentioned the matter to me. I wished that the summer and my son's harbour vacation would come so that we could get Edward to Europe. He was not, I soon saw, mending as rapidly as I had hoped he would, for there was something a bit hysterical in his occasional exhilaration, while his moods of fright and depression were altogether too frequent. The old Derby house was ready by December, yet Edward constantly put off moving, though he hated and seemed to fear the Crowninshield place. He was at the same time queerly enslaved by it. He could not seem to begin dismantling things, and invented every kind of excuse to postpone action. When I pointed this out to him, he appeared unaccountably frightened. His father's old butler, who was there with other reacquired family servants, told me one day that Edward's occasional prowlings about the house, and especially down cellar, looked odd and unwholesome to him. I wondered if Asenath had been writing disturbing letters, but the butler said there was no mail which could have come from her. It was about Christmas when Derby broke down one evening while calling on me. I was steering the conversation toward next summer's travels when he suddenly shrieked and leapt up from his chair with a look of shocking, uncontrollable fright, a cosmic panic and loathing, such as only the nether gulfs of nightmare could bring to any sane mind. "My brain! My brain, God damn it! It's tugging from beyond, knocking, clawing! That she-devil, even now, Ephraim! Camog! Camog! The pit of the Shoggoths! Yah, Shub-Niggurath! The goat with a thousand young! The flame! The flame! Beyond body, beyond life, in the earth! Oh, God!" I pulled him back to his chair and poured some wine down his throat as his frenzy sank to a dull apathy. He did not resist, but kept his lips moving as if talking to himself. Presently I realised he was trying to talk to me and bent my ear to his mouth to catch the feeble words. "Again? Again? She's trying? I might have known. Nothing can stop that force, not distance, not magic, not death. It comes and comes, mostly in the night. I can't leave, it's horrible. Oh, God, Dan, if you only knew as I do just how horrible it is." When he had slumped down in a stupor, I propped him with pillows and let normal sleep overtake him. I did not call a doctor, for I knew what would be said of his sanity, and wished to give nature a chance if I possibly could. He waked at midnight, and I put him to bed upstairs, but he was gone by morning. He had let himself out quietly, and his butler, when called on the wire, said that he was at home, pacing restlessly about the library. Edward went to pieces rapidly after that. He did not call again, but I went daily to see him. He would always be sitting in his library, staring at nothing, and having an air of abnormal listening. Sometimes he talked rationally, but always on trivial topics. Any mention of his trouble, of future plans, or of Asenath would send him into a frenzy. His butler said he had frightful seizures at night, during which he might eventually do himself harm. I had a long talk with his doctor, banker, and lawyer, and finally took the physician with two specialist colleagues to visit him. The spasms that resulted from the first questions were violent and pitiable, and that evening a closed car took his poor, struggling body to the Arkham Sanitarium. I was made his guardian and called on him twice weekly, almost weeping to hear his wild shrieks, awesome whispers and dreadful droning repetitions of such phrases as, "I had to do it, I had to do it. It'll get me. Down there in the dark. Mother, Mother, Dan, save me, save me." How much hope of recovery there was, no one could say. But I tried my best to be optimistic. Edward must have a home if he emerged, so I transferred his servants to the Derby Mansion, which would surely be his sane choice. What to do about the Crowanshiel place with its complex arrangements and collections of utterly inexplicable objects, I could not decide, so left it momentarily untouched, telling the Derby housemaids to go over and dust the chief rooms once a week and ordering the furnace man to have a fire on those days. The final nightmare came before Candlemas, heralded in cruel irony by a false gleam of hope. One morning, late in January, the sanatorium telephoned to report that Edward's reason had suddenly come back. His continuous memory, they said, was badly impaired, but sanity itself was certain. Of course, he must remain some time for observation, but there could be little doubt of the outcome. All going well, he would surely be free in a week. I hastened over in a flood of delight, but stood bewildered when a nurse took me to Edward's room. The patient rose to greet me, extending his hand with a polite smile, but I saw in an instant that he bore the strangely energized personality which had seemed so foreign to his own nature. The competent personality I had found so vaguely horrible, and which Edward himself had once vowed was the intruding soul of his wife. There was the same blazing vision, so like Asenath's and old Ephraim's, and the same firm mouth, and when he spoke I could sense the same grim, pervasive irony in his voice, the deep irony so redolent of potential evil. This was the person who had driven my car through the night 5 months before, the person I had not seen since that brief call when he had forgotten the old-time doorbell signal and stirred such nebulous fears in me. And now he filled me with the same dim feeling of blasphemous alienage and ineffable cosmic hideousness. He spoke affably of arrangements for release, and there was nothing for me to do but assent, despite some remarkable gaps in his recent memories, yet I felt that something was terribly, inexplicably wrong and abnormal. There were horrors in this thing that I could not reach. This was a sane person, but was it indeed Edward Derby, the one I had known? If not, who or what was it? And where was Edward? Ought it to be free or confined? Or ought it to be extirpated from the face of the earth? There was a hint of the abysmally sardonic in everything the creature said. The Asenath-like eyes lent a special and baffling mockery to certain words about the early liberty earned by an especially close confinement. I must have behaved very awkwardly and was glad to beat a retreat. All that day and the next I racked my brain over the problem. What had happened? What sort of mind looked out through those alien eyes in Edward's face? I could think of nothing but this dimly terrible enigma and gave up all efforts to perform my usual work. The second morning, the hospital called up to say that the recovered patient was unchanged and, by evening, close to a nervous collapse, a state I admit, though others will vow it coloured the subsequent vision. I have nothing to say on the point, except no madness of mine could account for all the evidence. It was in the night, after that second evening, that stark, utter horror burst over me and weighted my spirit with a black, clutching panic from which it can never shake free. It began with a telephone call just before midnight. I was the only one up and sleepily took down the receiver in the library. No one seemed to be on the wire, and I was about to hang up and go to bed when my ear caught a very faint suspicion of sound at the other end. Was someone trying, under great difficulties, to talk? As I listened, I thought I heard a sort of a half-liquid bubbling noise, which had an odd suggestion of inarticulate, unintelligible word and syllable divisions. I called, "Who is it?" But the only answer was, I could only assume that the noise was mechanical, but fancying that it might be a case of a broken instrument able to receive but not to send, I added, "I can hear you. Better hang up and try information." Immediately I heard the receiver go on the hook at the other end. This, I say, was just before midnight. When that call was traced afterward, it was found to have come from the old Crowanshiel house, though it was fully half a week from the housemaid's day to be there. I shall only hint what was found at that house. The upheaval in a remote cellar storeroom, the tracks, the dirt, the hastily rifled wardrobe, the baffling marks on the telephone, the clumsily used stationery, and the detestable stench lingering over everything. The police, poor fools, have their smug little theories and are still searching for those sinister discharged servants who have dropped out of sight amidst the present furor. They speak of a ghoulish revenge for things that were done and say I was included because I was Edward's best friend and advisor. Idiots. Do they fancy those brutish clowns? Do they fancy that they could have bought what later came? Do they really think I could have forged that handwriting? Are they blind to the changes in that body that was Edward's? As for me, I now believe all that Edward Derby ever told me. There are horrors beyond life's edge that we do not suspect, and once in a while, man's evil prying calls them just within our range. Ephraim, Asenath, that devil called them in, and they engulfed Edward as they are engulfing me. Can I be sure that I am safe? Those powers survive the life of the physical form. The next day, in the afternoon, when I pulled out of my prostration and was able to walk and talk coherently, I went to the madhouse and shot him dead, for Edward's and the world's sake. But can I be sure till he is cremated? They are keeping the body for some silly autopsies by different doctors, but I say he must be cremated. He must be cremated, he who was not Edward Derby when I shot him. I shall go mad if he is not, for I may be the next, but my will is not weak, and I shall not let it be undermined by the terrors I know are seething around it. One life, Ephraim, Asenath, and Edward, who now I will not be driven out of my body. I will not change souls with that bullet-ridden lich in the madhouse. But let me try to tell coherently of that final horror. I will not speak of what the police persistently ignored, the tales of that dwarfed, grotesque, malodorous thing met by at least three wayfarers in High Street just before 2 o'clock, and the nature of the single footprints in certain places. I will say only that just about two, the doorbell and knocker waked me. Doorbell and knocker both plied alternately and uncertainly in a kind of weak desperation, and each trying to keep to Edward's old signal of 3 and 2 strokes. Roused from deep sleep, my mind leapt into a turmoil. Derby at the door and remembering the old code. His personality had not remembered it. It was Edward, suddenly back in his rightful state. Why was he here in such evident stress and haste? Had he been released ahead of time, or had he escaped? Perhaps, I thought, as I flung on a robe and bounded downstairs, his return to his own self had brought raving and violence, revoking his discharge and driving him to a desperate dash for freedom. Whatever had happened, he was good old Edward again, and I would help him. When I opened the door, into the Elm Arch blackness, a gust of insufferably fetid wind almost flung me prostrate. I choked in nausea, and for a second scarcely saw the dwarfed, humped figure on the steps. The summons had been Edward's, but who was this foul, stunted parody? Where had Edward had time to go? His ring had sounded only a second before the door opened. The caller had on one of Edward's overcoats, its bottom almost touching the ground, and its sleeves rolled back, yet still covering the hands. On the head was a slouch hat pulled low, while a black silk muffler concealed the face. As I stepped unsteadily forward, the figure made a semi-liquid sound like that I had heard over the telephone, and thrust at me a large, closely written paper impaled on the end of a long pencil. Still reeling from the morbid and unaccountable fetor, I seized this paper and tried to read it in the light from the doorway. Beyond question, it was in Edward's script, but why had he written when he was close enough to ring, and why was the script so awkward, coarse and shaky? I could make out nothing in the dim half-light, so I edged back into the hall, the dwarf figure clumping mechanically after, but pausing on the inner door's threshold. The odour of this singular messenger was really appalling, and I hoped, not in vain, thank God, that my wife would not wake and confront it. Then, as I read the paper, I felt my knees give under me and my vision go black. I was lying on the floor when I came to, that accursed sheet still clutched in my fear-rigid hand. This is what it said. Dan, go to the sanatorium and kill it. Exterminate it. It isn't Edward Derby anymore. She's got me. It's Asenath, and she's been dead 3 months and a half. I lied when I said she had gone away. I killed her. I had to. It was sudden, but we were alone, and I was in my right body. I saw a candlestick and smashed her head in. She would have got me for good at Hallamass. I buried her in the father cellar storeroom under some old boxes and cleaned up all the traces. The servants suspected next morning, but they have such secrets that they dare not tell the police. I sent them off, but God knows what they and others in the cult will do. I thought for a while that I was all right, and then I felt the tugging at my brain. I knew what it was. I ought to have remembered. A soul like hers, or Ephraim's, is half detached and keeps right on after death as long as the body lasts. She was getting me, making me change bodies with her, seizing my body and putting me in that corpse of hers buried in the cellar. I knew what was coming. That's why I snapped and had to go to the asylum. Then it came. I found myself choked in the dark, in Asenath's rotting carcass, down there in the cellar, under the boxes where I'd put it. And I knew she must be in my body at the sanitarium. Permanently. For it was after Hallowmass, and the sacrifice would work even without her being there, sane and ready for release, as a menace to the world. I was desperate, and in spite of everything, I clawed my way out. I'm too far gone to talk. I couldn't manage to telephone, but I can still write. I'll get fixed up somehow and bring you this last word and warning. Kill that fiend. If you value the peace and comfort of the world, see that it is cremated. If you don't, it will live on and on, body to body, forever. And I can tell you, I can't tell you what it will do. Keep clear of black magic, Dan. It's the devil's business. Goodbye, you've been a great friend. Tell the police whatever they'll believe, and I'm damnably sorry to drag all this on you. I'll be at peace before long. This thing won't hold together much more. Hope you can read this and kill that thing. Kill it. Yours, Ed. It was only afterward that I read the last paragraph of this paper, for I had fainted at the end of the third paragraph. I fainted again when I saw and smelled what cluttered up the threshold where the warm air had struck it. The messenger would not move or have consciousness any more. The butler, tougher fibred than I, did not faint at what met him in the hall in the morning. Instead, he telephoned the police. When they came, I had been taken upstairs to bed, but the other mass lay where it had collapsed in the night. The men put handkerchiefs to their noses. What they finally found inside Edward's oddly assorted clothes was mostly liquescent horror. There were no bones. There were bones, too, and a crushed-in skull, and some dental work positively identified the skull as Asenath's. Well, that's the last story from H.P. Lovecraft for a while. Enjoy's not quite the right word, I suppose, but as I said, when you consider that he was writing in the 1920s and never really made all that much from his writings, it's interesting that, you know, like so many people, their capacity and ability seems to be recognised after they're gone. Well, there'll be something new next week. Until then, keep well, Braidwood, and wouldn't a decent fall of rain be nice? Bye for now.